Here we are for the afternoon session, which is going to, how did you call it here? You called it a workshop. And this is a workshop on the mind. And so that gives us a few areas to think about. Did anyone have any questions they'd like to have me start out with, or shall I just start out? Any questions? Okay, very good. This morning, in our talk, we talked about physician, fool thyself. This is from the Fortune magazine this month. It's called Physician, Fool Thyself. You know, it's an interesting term. And that Fortune magazine would have this article too. It's very interesting. And in the article, it had a statement here that they had, amazingly, both acupuncture worked. That's a sham acupuncture, but the sham acupuncture won, and the placebo. And both were used, and the dueling placebos even had side effects, with 15% of the people who took the placebos, 15% who had the placebo reported a feeling of drowsiness, and 20% with the other felt that they were feeling the fake acupuncture. They felt pain from feeling it. And that, of course, there was no touch. But you know that you can psychologically do things to people and they will respond to it. You can psychologically hit a person and they'll respond to it. You can psychologically give a person a frozen knife and say you're going to burn yourself and have them burn themselves. Yeah. An absolutely cold knife right out of the freezer and give it to them and they will feel it and they will think they're going to burn themselves. See, our mind is such an open vessel for any type of information that we want to put in it. Now, the picture here, I'll show it around again. The upper picture with the color in it, that's your brain with pain. And the lower picture with the whiteness in it is the picture with a placebo, having had nothing but a sugar pill, and the pain went away. The pain went right away. Now, a mother can kiss her child's knee, and the pain goes right away. A mother can say to the child, oh, no problem, get out and go out and play, or wash it off, or don't even wash it off. And the kid goes out, and he's whole perfect. Another mother worries about the kid having infection setting in, and infection sets in. The mind is a strange and a wonderful thing, creating all sorts of situations for us that are going to give us a lot of problems. Now, I have a picture here showing you something of what the mind has done, and people just have not realized it. And this is a picture from Discovery Magazine from this month, and I think it's this month, April, yep. Not April, but September. Well, it says it here. Doesn't say it all the time. But September. And in here is this picture here. See that little device? Mm-hmm. It's something that was found on the ocean floor in 1901. And it is the first computer. And 2,000 years ago, a ship went down in the Mediterranean, and it had this device on it. And that device was used by the Greeks for navigation, for recognizing the cycles of the stars and the moon and the sun, for recognizing all of these things and recognizing how to go places. That's this odd-looking thing. It had, I believe, 30 mechanical gears on it, and it said 2,000 inscribed Greek characters on it, which is what they used to do their machinations, you know, figuring out how to do these things. It's quite amazing that this would be. Now, it is no trivial matter, as the scientists say, to create a computer of that concept. Now, if any of you have ever been interested in science, or you've been, ever been interested in the early days of computing, you remember Archimedes, and you remember the various other fellows who worked in those days. What did they have? They had these beautiful globes. And on these globes, they had pictures, not pictures, but on these globes, they had the entire Earth. Now, this was before Galileo's time. This was long before Galileo's time, and long after Galileo's time. But then, what did Galileo come along and say? Anybody know?
The Earth was not the center of the universe.
The Earth was not the center of the universe. And the Earth...
Everything revolved around the Earth.
Mm-hmm. And what happened? Somebody disagreed with him. The Pope said no. He said, the Earth is the center of everything. And they... When did Columbus sail the ocean blue in 1492? When did Columbus sail the ocean blue? In 1492. Now, 1492, that's not that long ago. And what were they worried about? That he's going to fall off the edge of the flat Earth. Now, you see, when people, ships didn't come back, they fell off the edge of the flat Earth. Not that they had trouble with a storm, or they got shipwrecked in some island and they had no way to come back. You know, their boat was gone. But they fell off the edge of a flat Earth. Now, how long has that persisted? You look at a railroad track going right straight out there, and you see the lines converging, and you say to yourself, my gosh, that's a long, flat area. And is it? Then our friend Einstein comes along, and what does he tell us about the universe? The universe is an arced universe. It is not a straight line universe. There is no such thing as a straight line. Now, for us, from our thinking, we say that is totally stupid, totally unreasonable. Things are flat. Now, this is flat. You know, we put a lever on here, we put a plane on here, we put all sorts of instrumentation on there, we say that's flat. And it isn't. And you look out across the desert. Anybody ever driven on the desert around here? You look across the desert and you go on and on and on and on and on and on. And you think to yourself, my goodness sakes, how could they ever make a distance that long so flat and so beautiful until it comes to the mountain, you know? And then all of a sudden it goes up and what have you. But our eyes will see anything we want them to see. Our ears will hear anything they want to see, them to see and hear. We think that when the sun touches the ocean, it's going hiss, you know, and that hot globe is cooling off as it dips into the ocean. Well, obviously that's not true. But that's what we think. Now, if you tell a child that, a child will believe it. Now, why will a child believe it? Because it's not true, or because it's true? Because you said it. See, you're an authority. And a child will believe what you as an authority say. Now, we have to be very careful with where we find our authorities. We have to be very careful with where we find that which we trust to base our wisdom on. And what is it that you trust to base your wisdom on? Now, last time I was here, I told you about a book, and I'm telling you about the book again. I don't have the name of the book in front of me. But it's a book about the Bible. And it's not about the Bible as much as it is about the penmanship of the Bible. The early scribes who wrote the Bible, who put it down on paper, they wrote in Greek. And the early Greek, they actually wrote the first volumes in Aramaic. But they wrote it in Greek, these particular ones that are being used by later Bible scholars, and they have pictures of this, photographs of these things, you know, of these actual scrolls that they had. There are no periods, there are no commas, there are no spaces between the paragraphs, and no spaces between the words. Can you imagine reading words that is just, and it's just like that? Do you think you might misconstrue something? Do you think you might misunderstand something that is said in there because it is so difficult to read? Now, that, it's a lot of gobbledygook, writing is a lot of gobbledygook, that the writing is a lot of gobbledygook, and you can still read it perfectly as long as there's punctuation and spaces and paragraphs. Because they have, I think I sent it out in one of my emails one time, someone sent me a gobbledygook letter, and in it was, it said something like, when the sun comes up in the east, it is a lovely day because it is blue and good in that way, and so forth. You know. And then it says, under day it had just D-A, you know, and love, a love day, you know, and you put lovely in there because you know that should be there, and it is, and you say, is lovely day. You know, it's like the children might speak with poor English when they haven't got all their syntax put together. But you can read that perfectly well. And you read it because your intellectual mind puts in there what things you think should be there. And this is what the early scribes, scholars, writers, transcribers of biblical lore did. Now, in the days of Jesus, people did not know how to write. And Gutenberg hadn't been around yet, you know? You know the story of Gutenberg in the Bible, when he first came out with a printed Bible and printed forms. But anyhow, they didn't have that. They didn't have that. So, a few people could write. And nobody knew if they wrote rightly or not, but they could write. And then, in every town, they had to appoint, the governor had to appoint the Roman government who was in charge, had people there who were in charge. And so, these people were called scribes. But that didn't mean they could write. That only meant they could sign their name. And so when they would get a document, they would take that document and sign their name that they got the document and stick it in the file. And they wouldn't read it, nor would anybody else, because they couldn't read. And so this is why, if you read the New Testament, you read Revelations, the writers of Revelation say, and if you dare change one jot or one tittle of whatever I have written here, you'll go to hell, you know, and you'll be, and, you know, burn and burn, and you'll have all sorts of nasty things happening to you, because people were changing things to fit whatever they wanted to fit. And the leaders of the towns would go around writing these things. And they'd go around writing this what they understood to be the truth. Now, the fact is, as you well know, 30 to 50 years after the ascension, that interesting ascension, after the ascension of our friend, the Christ, these things started to be written down, and not before. Isn't that interesting? And so, quite likely, they were not written by John, Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John, and all the rest of them. Luke, perhaps, but Paul, perhaps, you know. But they weren't written by these people, because they weren't there. These people were now, the life, what was the life span of those people in those days? Speak loudly.
30
years. That's right, exactly. 30 years. That was the lifespan of people. Jesus was 33. He was an old man. He's an old man by their standards. But, and we call him a young man because it's by our standards. Now, when we realize this, they had to start writing early. They really had to start writing early. And then by the time they were learning to copy, as they did of the Jewish Bibles and the Jewish books, and they'd take down what the rabbis gave them or wrote, they became a little, a little creative as they were writing. Because they didn't have time to write it down right, and they didn't have time to listen and do things, and so they just sort of maybe had their own kind of shorthand. And so that we came up with the marvelous things that we did is utterly amazing. Your parents and your grandparents and your grandparents' parents had a very wonderful gift. they didn't have all of the medicines that we have today. They had to rely on the alternative medicines. They had to rely on what they found in the field. They had to rely on what the Indians had told them. They had to rely on the things that seemed to work, you know. And many of them died in the process, but many of them lived in the process. More lived than died happily. How about our medicines today? More die than live, you know, or more live than die, or die than live, whatever. But the point is, they listened intuitively to themselves. Now, where was the first aspirin taken from? What tree by the American Indians?
Willow.
Hmm?
The willow.
The willow tree. Aspirin and willow? Who would have dreamed that aspirin and its effects would come out of the willow tree? Every Indian who's riding on his horse, chewing on a willow stick, you know? You know, his poor bottom is beating on that horse, and he's chewing on a piece of willow stick, and the pain goes away. You know? The aspirin helps him to relieve himself of that pain. But who thinks of that? Now, whoever said that, you know? Now, where do these people find out about that? And so the Indians just say, well, you know, I didn't feel so bad while I was riding my horse, while I was chewing on that piece of willow. I will have to tell my kids that, and I will have to tell the tribe that, and I will have to tell the shaman that. And so the shaman says, no, 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 no. He goes out and gets some willow, and he says, no, I got a special potion here. And he has pounded up the willow and made the willow, and he's called it his. Because if the shaman doesn't call it his medicine, then it's not medicine. See? And this is what many of our alternative medical people do too. They want to make it their medicine. And it's a silly thing, a very silly thing, but it's pride. And it's the pride of creation, you might say, or the pride of our profession. Now, of course, that's not a problem that you have at all. All they do is just say, let us touch your neck and let us make you feel like you are 200%, you know, so that you are now whole and perfect, and that every organ of your action of your body is just flowing with an energy of pureness and wholeness, and you just feel like you're 100%. You just feel purr like pussycat. And that's good. But now, you don't have to know how to heal. You don't have to know how to use energy massage to do this. Because your love does it. The mother does it for her child. The mother takes the child's leg, and the child says, oh, my legs are so hurting. I'm having such dreams, you know, nightmares. And so the mother just sits there and massages the child's leg and says, what beautiful legs you have. They're growing so nicely. They're so strong and so wonderful. Oh, they're so relaxed. And the kid just falls right asleep, you know. You see, that love handles this. Now, you'd go to a shaman, and he would say, lay down. Now, use all of his interesting jargon to do the same thing, and same thing happens. Love. What is the healing agent? The healing agent is the agent of the mind. It's the love of the mind. It's like these articles that you're going to hear more about. The mind goes out and says whatever it wants to have, and then you have it. If you want to be sick, then you are sick. If you want to be well, then you are well. Now, where is she? Your wife. Oh, she just walked out.
She didn't have the restroom.
Huh?
She doesn't have the restroom.
But that's okay. She's welcome to do that. I was just going to talk about her, though. She was with us last night. And we were over at the barns, and we were in the barn's bottom in their pool. And we were puddling around in their jacuzzi and just having a great old time. And the upper temperature was nice and cool, nice cool evening. But in the jacuzzi, it was a nice, warm, snuggly temperature. And we were in there. Now, here we are, healthy people, wonderful people, and she got out of the jacuzzi, and then she sat there and dried herself off in no rush to get out of the cool night air, nor did Susan or Randy was in there too, or myself. And although I decided after the jacuzzi, I'm ready for bed. And I went to bed. But they sat out there for another 2 hours talking to him. Had no interest in... Don't mess up my stories. Had no interest in going in. Now, what I'm saying is that you, as a father, you'll say to your kid, now, you put your clothes on. Don't go outside like that. They're all wet and cold. You're going to catch a cold. You won't say that, would you? But, you see, parents say that to the kids. Put your goulashes on. You ever heard that? Around out here in New Mexico, put your goulashes on. Put your goulashes on. You know, put your buffer on. You know, put your clothes on. You know? And we instill the fact that if you don't do that, you're going to get sick. You're going to have a cold. You're going to have whatever problems might come from that. And this is so silly, but these are things that we foster upon ourselves. Our mind is perfectly ready to respond, perfectly ready to do whatever we say. I told you the story before, I'm sure, of these service people, not service people, the experiment that was done up in Alaska or someplace. Prisoners agreed to be part of a test. And there were servicemen there, too. And they agreed to be part of a test. They agreed to live on this piece of large canvas out in the winter with no clothes on, absolutely naked, for as long as they felt they could handle it, and so forth. And so they did. And the test was for about a week, but some didn't quite make the week, but most of them did. Not one of them had any kind of an illness. Not one of them felt bad about it. Some felt, I'm cold, and so they're cold. Others felt, I'm warm. I'm warm. I'm fantastic. I'm glorious. It's written up in, I don't have a copy of it, but it's written up in a report that was given back, oh, ages ago. It was done, oh, maybe 30 years ago. But it was just really fantastic what they had done. And none of them were sick. None of them took on any illness. None of them had the flu, the cold, or anything. And all of them felt reasonably comfortable. Oh, it was a little different from them because, and the minute they, then they were cold. If they just go around not paying any attention to it, you don't feel a thing. You don't feel a thing. One time I came in from a walk on my meditation path, and I came back from a walk. This is so... number of years ago, and my son, who was about 25 at the time, he looked at me and he says, Dad, did you see yourself? And I said, no. I was naked, and I came back from my path walk. And he says, go look in the mirror. So I looked in the mirror. Here I had snow on my head and my shoulders, and I didn't even know it. I didn't even know it, because I was so in my meditative mood. I was so in my introspection. I was so in my oneness with all. I felt none of those things. I felt no coolness. I felt none of those things. And he had to tell me to go and look, and he knew better than to tell me, look at your shoulders, and well, so what, you know. But the thing is, we have within us the possibility, the potentiality, the reality, actually, of living in our bodies in an absolutely magnificent way. Living in our body in a most perfect way. But we have to, now I'm going to say this is wrong after I'm done saying it. We have to get rid of all of the ideas that limit us. We have to get rid of all the ideas that limit us. We have to get rid of all those thoughts. Don't shake your head, yes. I'm telling you, I'm going to change this. We have to get rid of all those ideas that tell us that we can't do it. We have to get rid of all these ideas that say that we're human. We're just human. We can't do that. There's no way we can do it. We have to get rid of those ideas. Well, it won't work. You cannot get rid of those ideas. Those ideas are like the fingers on your hand. They're with you forever. Now, what can you do when you dumped a lot of garbage in your mind which said you're limited? What can you do? What? Thanks a lot. Now you know the answer, don't you? What you can do is to pump into your mind the reality about yourself. You are a divine person. I know that. You are a divine person. You can do anything you want to do because you have within you God. You have within you the power of the universe. You have within you the ability to think and do and act in any way you want. There's no limitation. The only limitation is that you say you can't. Now, stop saying you can't. But you won't stop saying you can't as long as you are saying you can't. You will stop saying you can't the minute you start saying I can. You know? Now, you're going to take a test. And it's an algebra test. And you go in there and you're taking this test in school. And this test says to you, all right, answer the questions. So you say, all right, I am going to use what Dr. Barley suggested and I'm going to say I know the answers. And so then he does the test. And he says, I know that the divine in me knows the answer. You heard that, didn't you? You did, didn't you? Your son remembers more things than you, my God. At the lunch table, he told me 12 or 15 things that I had said 3 years ago. But anyhow, good mind. I tell you, very good mind. Very good mind. But, so, you say, I know God in me knows the answer. And then what do? You write down every answer correct. And then the teacher says to you, wrong. Because if you are taking algebra, you have to write down how you arrived at the answer. You can't just write down the answer. Because the answer is not the point. The point is how you got there. The teacher has to know how you got there. The correct answer really doesn't matter because you can make some little minor mistake. But if you know the technique of how to get there, that's what they want to teach you. So, he wrote down all the correct answers and the teacher said, pop! Stupid. You cheated. You did something wrong. And then what happens? And then give me the test again. So he takes the test again. And so the teacher says, now, write down how you got every answer. Show us what way you arrived at that conclusion. And so he does. He says, I know. God only knows the answer. Flippant. You know? Because it's principle. 2 times 2 is 4, whether you say, two times 2 is 4, 2 times 2 is 4, 2 times 2 is 4. You can be as stupid as you want, but 2 times 2 is always going to be 4, right? The principle is always going to be there, right? Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm using you as an example. Okay, now, remember that. I know that I know the divine in me knows the answer. Okay, now. Will you be able to write down the entire manner in which you arrive at the solution? Yes. Because if you know, you know. And then you write it down. I had one young boy tell the story of Todd up in Duluth, Minnesota. And I was talking to his father, who wanted to pass his test as being a stockbroker. And he had a mathematical part, and he's having difficulty. And his boy, Todd, I think 13, standing around the corner listening because he didn't want us to hear him and know he was listening. And so I said to the father, just say, I know, and you will do everyone perfectly. And so next day the father went in and did it. He did everything perfectly. He passed. He got his brokerage. You know, they didn't know he cheated. You know, he went to a bigger source. He went to his computer inside of himself. Hey, cool, you know. And but he did. Okay, so Todd, his son, went to school and said, I know, God in me knows the answer like that, you know, and took the test and passed it, but he only put down the answers. He didn't put down how he got to them. And so the teacher was very angry with him and called the father in and said, your son cheated. He says, well, how could my son cheat? He got all the right answers. Well, he copied other people's papers. Did everybody get all the right answers? No. Then how did he get the right answers on the ones that the others got that didn't get the right answers on, you know? And the teacher said, well, he cheated, you know. He did something. He never has gotten right answers on his algebra test. Never. So they call the principal in. And the principal says, well, give him another test. And so they gave him another test. And he told him, write down how you got it. So, before the test, 2 seconds. I know. God only knows the answer. And he took the test, did it right. Perfect. Now, there are other examples. I use these because they're easy to come to mind. We can do that. I had another boy in El Centro, California. He was going into the scouts, the Eagle Scout. And to be an Eagle Scout, he had to get good grades in school. And he's doing bad in history. And so he said to me, as his counselor, he said, what am I going to do? And I said, well, I know that I know that I know. God only knows the answer. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You've done your studies. You've done your thing. You should know it. You know, there's no reason you shouldn't know it. Just believe in yourself. So he took the test. I know that I know that I know. God only knows the answer. And passed. Now, there are many more. But repeating them isn't going to help you believe in it anymore. The point is, when you believe in yourself, you have the capacity to do anything you want to do. When you believe in yourself. Now, Randy just hurt his finger. And he says, oh my God, I need that to type with, you know. I can't type with just four fingers, you know. And so, he says, I can't go around like this with one finger out of action. And so he said to himself, okay, I live in my ideal spirit, mind, and body. I live in my ideal spirit, mind, and body. And he straightened up like a person who really lives in his ideal spirit, mind, and body. And he walked around like a person who really lives in his ideal spirit, mind, and body. As though he were really proud of himself and proud of his body. And his friend came up to him and said, well, how are you doing there, buddy? And he said, my God, what'd you do to me? And his friend says, nothing, but why? Well, my finger didn't work before, and now look, it works perfect. And the friend says, well, whatever it was, if I did it, I'm glad. I was kind of nice. Ah, yeah, he says, I did it to myself. I live in my ideal spirit, mind, and body. I live in my ideal spirit, mind, and body. Every organ, action, function of my body is perfect. Every organ, action, function of my body is absolutely perfect. And you see, then he experienced it. But he was so sort of unconscious of the power that he was using, that when it happened, he says, look, how'd that happen? You know, a moment ago, it didn't work. Now it works just fine. Well, maybe it was always working, and he just thought it didn't work. Maybe it always does work, and we sometimes think it doesn't. Maybe, here, there's this person sitting right here. You don't want to be the person. This person is sitting right here. And this person gets cancer. And one cell in their body says, I don't like you. I don't like you. I'm going to be free. I'm going to go do anything I want to do. And then it goes, and divides and becomes bigger, bigger, bigger. And pretty soon it takes over a whole chunk of your body as a chunk of cancer. You know? One cell that didn't get the message. And all the while, you're saying, oh dear me, what's this going on inside of me? What's this going on? Oh dear me, you know, instead of saying, hey, my body is the temple of the living spirit. Every organ, hey, this is the church, the fellowship of the spirit? My body is the temple of the living spirit, of the fellowship of the spirit. My body is the temple of the fellowship of the spirit. My body is the living spirit. Every organ, action, function of my body is perfect. Now, cell, you're now a number of cells, but the original daddy cell, you get back in shape. Back in shape. One. The rest of you, poof, off with it. One. One cell. One cell, your home period. One cell. Within moments, you can have that back perfect. And it's been done. And it's easily done. One moment, and you are back to your original purity and integrity, and how wonderful that is. But it's your choice. It's your choice. It's your choice. The moment you allow yourself to linger longer than a moment on these things in the negative, you're going to have that expiate itself. It'll just grow and grow and grow and grow and grow. It'll just become so fantastic, so glorious. I had a woman who had cancer, and she's a little super lady. And you just couldn't help but love her, love her, love her. And she was a very lovable lady, very gentle, very kind. Her kids loved her, her husband loved her. Everybody in her family just loved her, loved her, loved her. And so she had this experience. And I said to her, hey, you know what? You don't need that. She says, I know I don't want it. And I said, well, you're whole and perfect. She says, yes, I know I am, but why doesn't it go away? And I said, I tell you what. You go in the bathroom, or kitchen, wherever you keep it, and get out your baking soda. Get out your baking soda. And take a couple of spoons of it in a glass of water, you know, make a nice paste out of it, and put that paste right all over that thing. And then rinse it off. And it'll all poof right away. I mean, oh, she was a believer, you know. And so she put this paste on there, expecting it to work, expecting it to rinse away, and poof, it went away. It went right away. You say, my God, is that really true? No, I'm telling you a lie. No, that's really true. Does it have to be baking soda? Can it be baby powder? Can it be what?
It can be mud.
Mud!
We know a famous person who put mud on mud.
Eyes. I heard of mud. Yeah. Yeah, mud. Now, why do mud baths work for some people and not work for other people? You know? Some people expect it to work and some people don't. It's here. It's not here that the mud is working. It's here. It's not here that the food is working in your body. It's here in your mind. You can go into the restaurant and you can eat the stupidest food and come out feeling just fine. You can be at home and eat the perfect food, the ideal food that has always satisfied you, and for some reason or other, you didn't feel satisfied. For some reason or other, the food just was not right, even though it was ideal in every way. Now, why is it? It's here. Now, some people can go into Wendy's and they can eat their hamburger, and their hamburger is fantastic. Other people go into Wendy's and they come out with big hips and big bodies and all that kind of stuff. Hey, what is it that they're doing? They're doing just one thing. They're having a mental attitude about it. You know, I don't mean to be mean to you, but two things. And if this is a Christian church of sorts, but the thing is, what did Jesus say? Did Jesus say, seek ye the presence of the Father within? Did he say it? So, in other words, the presence within. Now, and he say, it's done unto you according to your belief? Yep. And what's another thing he said? What did he say?
It's not what goes in a man's mouth.
See, he knows it. He knows it. It's not what goes into the mouth, but what comes out of the mouth that makes you the person that you are. You can eat and eat and eat and eat and eat and be untouched by it. Be untouched by it. Or you can eat and be touched by it according to what you have been trained and taught from childhood on as to what it is. Now, some people say that their heaviness is a gene problem. Randy, how are genes developed in the body?
I have no idea.
Randy said genes are developed in the body by mental attitudes. Mental attitudes. It's not by the foods we eat. You said that last night. It's not by the foods we eat. If you didn't say it, you should have, because it's a nice thing. Our genes, we think, are predisposed from before birth, from our family tree and so forth like that. And that's not true. That's not true. These things can be that way if that's what we believe they are, and that's what we are taught that they are, then that's what they are. But if you believe that your genes are the expression of your mental attitude, maybe you want to say the expression of the foods that you eat, and that can be too. Science says, don't eat eggs, they're not good for you. Science says, eat 2 eggs every day, and you'll be healthy as a fox. And science says, eat eggs, but no yolks, because the yolks are bad for you. Yuck, yuck, yuck. You know, and science says everything. Now, I might add, we have a great book that says everything too. The Bible tells you everything. To go and kill people and not to kill. The Bible says, now, Abraham, Moses, yeah, Moses. Moses, when he came down from the mountain, he gave him this bill of goods that said, thou shalt not kill. And then he says, okay, fine. You go in there and take the people. Joshua fit the battle of Jericho, Jericho, Jericho. Joshua fit the battle of Jericho. And the walls came tumbling down. You see, he taught his people to go into the land of milk and honey, but to take her homeland, not the vacant land over here, and get her out of the city of Jericho, because she had no right to be there, even though she built it, you know, right? And get those people out of that. They don't deserve it. And now, here Abraham, Moses, who was teaching the people, thou shalt not kill, tells them, go and slaughter all the Jerichoites. Get rid of them. And as they marched around the city, the walls came tumbling down. Must have been unstable walls, but it came tumbling down. But wonderful things happen. Do you understand? Yes, our mind is so reflective and subjective, and so it's so easy to say things to our mind. Now, as we said before, you have all this garbage in you, and you got to get it out so that you can start living a fulfilled and complete life. And the only way to get it out is not to get it out. Anything that you put in your mind is there forever. Anything you put in your computer is there until you put in a new hard disk. Which is like death, you know. Or until you erase it. But then you better be careful, because it might still be there, hidden in some nook and cranny that you don't know about. Because how many times have you erased your hard disk or erased your computer and you found that the phantom was still there? The phantom with everything on it. Everything on it. How can they go into people's computers and find their hidden discussions that are on disks that they have erased, and put other things on because they didn't want anybody to find it? They knew how to go about it because they knew what they were looking for. They went in there and they found those things. You see, that's what our brain is. Our brain is like that. The things are always there. Now, you say, well, then what hope is there? The only hope is this. That we put a new program in motion. Okay. Any of you who are computer interested at all, you buy a computer and you have WordPerfect on it. And then you go out of WordPerfect and you go into Word, Microsoft Word, and then you're in Microsoft Word, and you're in Microsoft Word, what are the earlier names of it? And then you go into 2003. And now they're coming out with 2004, and Apple is 2004. And they're coming out with 2005 this year from Microsoft, which is going to be an upgrade on all that stuff. And you're going to upgrade all of your material on your computer. Well, now, the nice thing and the really interesting thing is this. You pay $400 for a new copy of 2005, maybe $500, and you can have an upgrade for $195. So you buy an upgrade even though you don't have Microsoft on your computer. And if you are smart, you'll press the right button which says, yes, I have it, yes, I'll give you a number, and so forth. And maybe you cheat from a number that somebody else had had. And it puts the entire new system on your computer, even without having had the old there, which is kind of nice. Which is like a baby would like to have its own information, its own brand new information, which is so pure and so perfect. But we don't have that. So when you are working on your computer and you have Word 2005, then stay in Word 2005, but know you want to go back to 2004. You want to go back to 2000 because you had a lot of good things you learned then. And you don't want to have to relearn those things on the new things. And so you bring the old into the new. And when you bring the old into the new, you bastardize the new. And in bastardizing the new, you make the new imperfect, improper, and not beneficial to you. Really. This is what people do. And it's our fault. Because what we want to do... Who sang that for us, or who talked there? Did you? No, somebody. About being born new. You sang that. You sang that, didn't you? Mm-hmm. About being born new. Okay, now, how in the world are you going to be born new if you're going to hang on to the old? You can't. You got to let go of the past, let go of the old, and be born in the new. Now, can we do that? We do it all the time. We do it all the time. We hear new ideas all the time. We hear new thoughts all the time. We hear new dreams all the time. We hear new ideas all the time. And sometimes we pay attention to them and sometimes we don't. Now, if we don't pay attention to them, what happens to us? Then we're lost. Then we're lost. He drove horse and buggies. And actually we didn't, but our parents did. But they drove horse and buggies. My mom drove horse and buggy. One time she was petting her horse and the horse bit her on the nose. Never forget. I heard hearing about it. But anyhow, she drove horse and buggy. Now, do you think mother never got happy with a car? One time I had a broken leg and a cast and so forth, and mother was driving me around town, and she wasn't supposed to drive the car because Pop didn't like her to drive the car, and had no faith in her. And so Pop was going to be home in the next 2 days, and so already she was nervous. And she drove back all over the city. She drove me, everything's perfect. She comes into our front yard, and first she veers to the left and hits a tree, a big old elm tree there that's, you know, like so big around. And you know what that did to the bumper? It's a number of years ago. Then she went up on the front lawn and knocked off the front porch. Then she backed up, came around, and got back in the driveway somehow, and then pushed in the garage doors and finally stopped. And when Dad got home, he was quite surprised. But she believed in herself all the time while she was driving around. The minute she got home and got into the environment of Pop being there soon, you know, then she was a scared chicken. And it is so silly. It is so silly. Why do we lose our cool? We lose our cool because somewhere in us we are taught that we are not good. We're taught that we are not competent, that we're not capable, that we're not absolutely fantastic. We're taught that we are just unworthy. And as long as we believe that, we're going to put that to work in other areas. We're going to put that to work in other areas of our life, and the same goes for illness. We're going to put to work in the areas of illness in our life that because we have been naughty people, that's why we have our illness. Because you were naughty as a child, because you wouldn't mind your mother. Today, you have this problem, you know. You have arthritis today. Well, my God, you know, everybody's got arthritis, and so that everybody didn't mind their mother when they were a child. No, that's not the point. The point is, these are thoughts that get to us. Now, the Course in Miracles teaches you to forgive, you know, okay. Now, do you teach yourself to forgive? You see, Jesus said, I come not to destroy the law and the prophets, remember? But I come to give you two new commandments. Love the Lord thy God, dwelling within you, with all your heart, soul, and being, spirit, and love your neighbor like yourself. Now, if you love your neighbor like yourself, and you don't love yourself, that neighbor's not going to get a very good deal, is it? But if you love yourself, that neighbor's going to really get a good deal. Get a wonderful relationship. Now, are you ready to put that cause in motion for you so that you can have the wholeness and the purity and the perfection that you are? Now, I want to digress for a moment on this possibility here for you. I will show you the pictures and then we'll talk about it. We spoke about it during our talk this morning. But within the body are cells. Remember we talked about cells? And these cells are ready to listen to you. And here's a photograph of mice cells that have been made after being touched by a stem cell. They have been returned to their original undifferentiated beingness. In other words, they don't know whether they're going to be a nose or an ear or whatever, you know. But they're returned to their undifferentiated beingness. And because they're returned to that, they are free to be anything. Now, I'm going to read you some information about this. which tells how the scientists did it, as we spoke this morning. But I want you to consider that it goes beyond that. It goes beyond what the scientists have done to make it happen. And it goes into an area which is called the area of your mind. That you can return in the area of your mind to your original purity and your original integrity. And you return to that area by thought alone. Now, here's what the scientists have done. I've got it up here. And I read it to you this morning. Read it again, because it's a good thing. In fact, this, as Randy read it the other night, with the name of the scientist, Yakamakabuji, you know, really interesting name. But anyhow, stem cell potential. A Japanese geneticist discovered a cocktail to stimulate the development of stem cells in adults needing their presence. Working with mice, he found when cells were forced to fuse with stem cells, occasionally one of the adult cells reprogrammed itself and regresses back to an undifferentiated state. By studying the chemical signals released by the cells when they undergo this transformation, he has managed to concoct a cocktail of four chemicals that provide the same conversion. Acknowledged it is not yet perfect. It works in a small percentage of attempts, but it does work. If it works at all, as projected, doctors may be able to grow stem cells from the adult cells of patients needing treatment. Researchers already envision transplanting ready-made embryonic stem cells back into people, providing cures for huge ranges of diseases from diabetes to paralysis to Alzheimer's. With no problem of ethics because it's not from a human being. And isn't that interesting? Now, what is going on there? This stem cell is touching the cell of the body, any cell, and moving it back to its original purity and integrity, to its undifferentiated form. Original purity and integrity. So, it is moving that cell back to its original purity and integrity. So we're going to take one cell from you, and we're going to put it in a petri dish here, and we're going to take a stem cell and introduce it with it, and have them have a relationship, you know. And then all of a sudden, your cell is purified by this. We have to add the cocktail. You can have the cocktail too, you know. And so when you add the cocktail of these four chemicals, or whatever they said here, four chemicals, yeah, it makes the cocktail something viable. And then her cell takes on a whole new attitude, a whole new genre, undifferentiated self. That means it has no purpose except to be a cell. And then it entered back into her body, and her body all of a sudden, you know, and that cell just transforms the entire body into its original purity. And it seems impossible. It seems improbable. It seems totally unrighteous. But that's what it does. And that's what they're working on. And the whole body transforms to its original purity and integrity. The stem cell, or the undifferentiated cell, has so much power because it has no knowledge of the limitation that the body has put upon itself over its years of experience. You understand me? It has so much power because it's not working against anything, it's just being itself. Now, go ahead, argue with me. Tell me I'm full of beans. Tell me I'm silly. Tell me I'm crazy. But let me tell you something else. Let me tell you something else. You take a cancer cell. You know what that is? A cancer cell is a cell within your body that didn't get the message of what its job is. And what does it do? It wipes you out. It completely emaciates you. It completely destroys you. It completely eats you up. Oh, does that sound good? My goodness sakes. One cell that didn't get the message, a cancer cell, and your body is shot. One cell that gets the message, and your body is saved. And here she is, this young spring chicken. We take her diapers and have her all set there, and she's just beautiful. But, do you understand? Yes, this is not a joke. What I am telling to you today may have been thought by other people and may not. But I'm thinking it with you today. You're stimulating my mind to think in that particular direction. But one cancer cell can completely destroy your body, right? And it has done that. And your mind has the possibility of saying to that one cancer cell, hope! You're out of bounds. You know? You're out of the game. Out! 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 And so the cancer cell is no longer invited. Is no longer allowed to play with the rest of the team. And out he goes. And if it doesn't want to go, what does the coach do? The coach calls the game's over. If you don't want to play by the rules of the game's over. And the body dies. The game is over. That's what happens. But if you believe in yourself so confidently, confidently, joyously, and say, I live in my ideal spirit, mind, and body. Every cell of my body is whole and perfect. Every cell of my body is whole and perfect. Every cell of my body is whole and perfect. Every cell of my body is whole and perfect. Then that's the only way it can be. But if you allow yourself to think of the cancer cell and it going out of balance, so be it. Now, this is how these stem cells function. This is how these stem cells, they're not told yet what to do. They haven't. Where does a stem cell get the message of what it's supposed to be? Where does a stem cell get the message of it's supposed to be a nose or an ear or an eye or something? Where does it get the idea? Where? Do any of you know? Is there some great book that we have, and you have to open that book to the stem cell, read the book, and it says, now stem cell, you are a stem cell, and you are of such capacity. Now, stem cell, you're going to be a boy. You're going to be a girl. Stem cell, you're going to be a cripple. Or you're going to be whole and perfect. Or stem cell, you're going to be beautiful. Or you're going to be sad looking. You know, stem cell, you're going to be this or that. Stem cell, you're going to be an Italian. You know, you're going to be a German, a Greek, you know, a Frenchman. You're going to be an American, Indian. You know, the stem cell gets this information from where? You say from the DNA structures and the other types of genes and chromosomes that are going into the inner beingness of the body. Well, where did they come from? Well, they came from the parents. Okay, now, which one of those are going to be effective? Which one of those are going to be dominant with the stem cell? Which ones are going to say to the stem cell, hey, 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 cool. Now, we looked at that little baby that was in church today. And the little baby was a rather attractive child. And everybody said, well, he looks just like his handsome daddy. You know, he looks just like his fabulous daddy. You know, his fabulous dad. Well, actually, he looks just like his mother. He has all the gentleness and all the self-confidence and all the beauty and so forth of his mother. Oh, he has many qualities of his father, to be sure. But really, when you look at him carefully and without judging, you see his mother all over him. Now, why? Why don't you see his father all over him instead of his mother? Now, his grandma is going to see his father all over him, and another grandmother is going to see his mother all over him. You know, her mother is going to see her daughter all over that child, you know. And why? Now, if she stays with that child is going to look like her son. If grandma, her mother stays with the child, it's going to look like the grandma, I mean, like the daughter. But why? What causes those cells that were his genes more positive or powerful than hers? Were his chromosomes or her chromosomes more powerful? What brought about these results? Well, actually, none of them. Many children look nothing at all like their parents. Many children have no limitations that their parents had. Many parents are crippled or have many other great problems, and the children don't. What a blessing for the children, you say. But many children don't have the sins of the parents vested upon them, as they want to say. But where does it come from? It is a mobile thing. It is a transient type of experience that is brought about by our thought. And our thought is the creative cause that brings these things into being. Our thought is the creative action that determines what the result is going to be. Now, we, by our thought, can have this stem cell mutate with our cell and make a transformation in our entire body instantly if we wish. And all we do is put the right thoughts in motion. Do you have the ability to put that thought in motion? And the answer is no. But when you don't think about it, you have the ability. When you do something purposely, you're doing it contrary to what is happening. And because you're doing it contrary to what is happening, you're fighting. And when you fight, you are fighting a losing battle because you're going against what you feel is the truth, you know? You feel that this kid is going to look like its grandma, or like its mother, or like its father, or whatever. You've already got a preconceived notion. And then you say, but grandma has a hooked nose like a witch, you know, and grandma has this and that. That poor kid, no, you know. And so then you're fighting. You're fighting. Now, I suggest to you, if you can just think scientifically, then you stay out of trouble. If you think emotionally, you get into trouble. And thinking emotionally is where you say, it looks like somebody, or it appears like something, or it appears this way. You say, my body is the temple of the living spirit. Every organ, action, function of my body is purged right now. My body is a temple of the living spirit. Every organ, action, function of my body is purged right now. I live in my ideal spirit, mind, and body. I live in my ideal spirit, mind, and body. I live in my ideal spirit, mind, and body. I live in my ideal spirit, mind, and body. I live in my ideal spirit, mind, and body. I live in my ideal spirit, mind, and body. I live in my ideal spirit, mind, and body. I live in my ideal spirit, mind. Oh, come on, Herb, come on. It's enough. It's enough. I am just bashed out with that. Yes. Do that to yourself. Bash yourself out with it. Speak the truth about yourself so wonderfully and so joyously. You know, I'm glad you don't live near me. Because I walk my morning path and I say, I like me, I like me. I'm a wonderful guy, I'm really like me. I'm fantastic. Oh, I dance along the path and I sing along the path. My dog jumps up and down with me and he sings with me. And he says, and I say, I like me, I like me, I like me. I live in my ideal spirit, mind, and body. I'm whole and perfect, 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 I'm whole and perfect. Ah, somebody hearing me say, my God, you got a problem there. What's the matter? Aren't you whole and perfect? I'm whole and perfect. That's the only thing I'm thinking about. You see, and that's all that matters. Now, it is true. The coyotes do hear me. And the ground squirrels and perhaps other creatures that are around, they do hear me. And maybe some of the international travelers who are hiding in the bushes waiting for me to walk by are hearing me. But they speak mostly Spanish, and so they don't know what I'm saying, but they think I'm a crazy nut. And it's wonderful. But I am so fantastic. I am so happy. I am so filled with joy and peace and power and every other good thing. It's amazing. It's amazing. Now, I told you I'm, what did I say last time, 1,259 years old or something like that. But whatever I am, I don't know. But I am youthful in spirit. And I am youthful in body. I am youthful in attitude. I am youthful in everything I do. I could die tomorrow. And I'd be perfectly happy. I've done everything I want to do, and I'm doing everything I want to do every moment of my life. And I'll probably just live forever, you know. But live forever in my ideal spirit, mind, and body. And the doctor said to me on my annual examination, he says, Herb, you know, you're very stupid. I said, oh, thank you very much, doctor. He says, your body is the body of a 20-year-old, but you're carrying around all that extra weight, and it's kind of silly. And I said, well, thank you very much. Yeah, it's very nice of you to say that. And he says, if you don't get rid of that, you're going to create problems for yourself. So I said, okay. So I was 230, and so I decided, okay, I am going to, at every meal, except at her house, at every meal and the restaurant, I am going to eat a one-third portion of whatever food is served. A one-third portion. So my family at the ranch, they serve me a one-third portion. They say, Herb, is this enough, you know? And a one-third portion of what their portion is looks kind of tiny on the plate. But, hey, you become accustomed to it. And I just have a half a slice of toast with my eggs in the morning. And I do have eggs. Usually just one egg. Poached egg or whatever they feel like making. And I brought my weight down from 230 down to 200. Plop! Like that, no problem, and stayed there. Then I brought it down from 200 to 290. And, excuse me, shut up, 190. From, what did I say? It was 230 down to 200, then down to 190. I mean, thank you very much. Hey, but, you know,
at least I'm paying attention
to. Make sure I say what I'm saying. At 190. And thank you. And then, as of late, it's been saying 185. And I find that very nice. And when it says 175, I will be at my BMI. And that is supposed to be very good. But every pound I lose, I feel better and better and better. Not because I'm lighter, but because I don't need that. I don't need that. I feel fantastic. I feel great. I feel just wonderful. I feel so myself. And you can too. You can too. But it's not a matter of making something happen. It's putting a new mental attitude. I had my driver's license made 20 years ago, or whenever the last time was, and I had put down 175 as my weight. You know. And I wasn't that at all. And but now I am moving into the range of my expectation. Now, here we have a statement, and it says that these drugs that are given to man are beneficial when the person has the expectation they're going to work. If the person does not have the expectation they're going to work, even if the drugs are drugs, they don't work. Now, what did it say about that one laryngitis or something, or not some sort of a throat disease?
Strep throat?
Strep throat. It says strep throat, you need to have some sort of drug to clean it up. That mental work won't do it. Well, they don't know. Mental work does everything. Why? Because this is a mental body. This is not a physical body. It's a mental body. Now, if we want it to be a physical body, you're going to have to feed it. But if it's a mental body, and if it's a spiritual body, you will get to the day when you don't need to drink, or breathe, or eat anything. And there are people who are doing that today. There are people who have done that historically, and they are the exception to the rule. And wherever there's an exception to the rule, that's the new rule, isn't it? Wherever the exception to the rule is, that's the new rule. So, think about these things. I'm not promoting that you do those things. I'm only saying to you that the mind has a capacity far beyond anything we know. Now, let's go back to our brain cell here that we were talking about. This, not brain cell, but the stem cell thing here. And let's see how well I read that to you. Tokyo University geneticist Shinya Yamakaka, Y-A-M-A-N-A-K-A, recently hit on a way to convert any normal adult cell into a immortal brain stem cell, capable of both living forever and morphing into any type of organ or tissue needing replacement in a sick or aging body. Isn't that spectacular? This is Discover magazine, which is a reputable magazine, and they check their sources. And these are guys, we've got their name here, of who are doing these things, and it's amazing. Okay, now. One of the biggest hurdles in stem cell research has been getting them. So far, scientists' only option are harvesting new stem cells from human embryos or cloning those already harvested. Both practices are fraught with an ethical and regulatory red tape. Yamakaka knew of another way through mice. In mice, when adult cells are forced to fuse with stem cells, now that'd be interesting to find out how he forces to fuse it, occasionally, one of the adult cells reprograms itself, regressing back into the undifferentiated state of the original self. Okay. By studying the chemical signals released by the cells as they undergo the transformation, Yamahawa has managed to concoct a cocktail of four chemicals that can provide the same conversion. Granted, the technique is not perfected. It works, and it is only a small percentage of the attempts, and hasn't yet been shown to be effective on human cells. Still, it's very solid, very convincing, and an exciting work. It's really an important first step, says the principal university gynecologist at Princeton University, Ivor Lagarakasham. Yamahashash. Technique. They would like the way I pronounce their names. Yamanaka's technique may enable doctors to grow stem cells from the adult cells of patients needing treatment. Researchers already envision transplanting ready-made embryonic stem cells back into people, providing cures for a huge range of diseases, from diabetes, paralysis, Alzheimer's, and no embryo or ethics committee is needed. Now, that's very interesting. Now, how are we going to implement this in our life? Well, we implement it in the things that I've been sharing with you. We implement it by our thoughts. Because when we start knowing such a thing exists, then our ability to have an expectation for it, a conceivability of it happening, takes place. And when we have this expectation or conceivability of something happening, then we can work it. Now, little children, if they can see by their parents, example, how to live a good life, the children will live a good life. If they see by their parents how they live a miserable life, how they are stuck on drugs, stuck on alcohol, stuck on bad language, stuck on picking on the neighbors, on arguing about everything, on being totally unsympathetic with the world and rednecked about everything in the universe, the kids are going to be like that. And the kids are going to have bodies that are going to be fraught with all sorts of problems. All sorts of problems. Because they are living by the example of their parents. Now, when you have a coach who works with a soccer team, and the coach says to the kids, "All right, boys and girls, if you haven't, all right, kids, come here. this is how we play this game, and this is what we do. Okay, now, go back and play. And then, they don't get the message. So, the coach, come on, and immediately they're all antagonized, they're all irritated, they're all bent out of shape, and they want to kick the coach where it's going to do the most good. And the coach tries to get across to him, and it doesn't work. But the coach, who is a master of himself first, he says, hey, gang, come on in here. Come on in here. Now, look, sit down here. You know, you guys, when you listen to the rules and you play by the rules, the game's lots of fun. But when you don't play by the rules, the game's not that much fun because nobody knows what to expect from you. We are a team that works in cooperation with one another. We are a team that works for the team effect. We want to win the game as a group, not by having some martyr out there who's going to lead the group and take all the credit and the rest of the group didn't do anything. We're not here to play that type of game. If you want to do that, lift weights. You know, but if you want to play a team game, if you want to be in a team sport, then you work as a group. You learn to cooperate together. You learn to put the ball over here so he can put the ball over there so they can do these different things. And now, how many of you want to be on a team sport, or how many of you want to be on an individual sport like tennis or something like that? And I want to go play tennis. Go and play tennis. That's where you belong. You'll really enjoy it. I want to be on the team sport because I like being with my buddies, and I like playing with my buddies, and I like doing things with my buddies, you know. And that's where you belong. And so then he says, all right, now, let's go out there and be a team. And so they go out on the field and they play as a team because the tennis player left. And they have a great time. But you see, one player in the team who is not a team player can mess up the whole team. You know that. I had children living at the ranch for a while, and these children came from parents who were unable to be in the sun, and they didn't like certain foods, and they were lactose intolerant. And the children came to the campus and lived there for a while, and we eat as a group. And I told them, okay, when they decided they didn't want to eat everything on the table, I said, you eat everything that's on the table. That milk that we have, it's on the mountain here. Of course, it came from the valley. But it's on the mountain here. And that is no problem. You'll have no lactose intolerance from that milk. That milk is just so perfect and so wonderful. In fact, you'll want to drink so much of it, you'll run us out of the house and home with drinking the milk. But you'll love it. Well, it was not more than a meal or two, and they were drinking it like, you know, soda water. Just loving it. Because they no longer thought they were lactose intolerant. Then, these kids who were red-haired skin, you know, and sensitive to the sun and so forth, they couldn't go in the sun. I said, I don't care. I said, here's a swimming pool. We put in a little swimming pool for them. And so, next thing you know, I said, this sun up here is on the mountain. It's not the sun down the valley. The sun down the valley, that seems to burn people. But up here, it doesn't burn people. It just kisses you. Kisses your body and makes you feel fantastic and wonderful. And so, they took off their clothes and, like, naked little jaybirds, jumping in and out of the pool, in and out of the pool all day long, coming in only for meals, and then going to bed, and the next day, and the next day, and the next day, they were brown as bears. Perfectly. Not one burned at all. Not one burned at all. Because they were told they don't have to be burned. And they believed it. Expectation. They believed it, and they experienced it. I had a 3-month school of the master on the ranch, where I had 18 adults and men and women from every walk of life, and very important people and very unimportant people by society's terminology, but wonderful people. And they all chose to go naked. And I told them, whatever you guys choose, that's your business. You don't have to do anything. You can do whatever you want. And they did. Then they chose to go bald. They chose to shave the women too. And some of those women had beautiful heads. But they chose to shave the hair off. This was July, August, September, on the mountain in Southern California, year 2000. Not one of them had, I gave them suntan lotion and all that kind of stuff. Not one of them used it. Not one of them had a sunburn. Not one of them even reddened. They just tanned and tanned and tanned. And, of course, they were taught principles, like I'm teaching you right now, every day. I like me, I like me, I like me. I am divine order. I am peace. Every moment, every moment, every moment, they said those things. Every moment. And at the end of the 3 months, they didn't want to go home. At the end of those 3 months, when they did go home, they said, oh, nothing happened. Of course not. You know, you don't know anything happened. You are the happening. And your family says, man, you're different. You know, you're nice or something. You know, they don't know. You're just a self-confident, loving person who loves yourself and thinks that you're wonderful. It has nothing to do with whether they wore clothes or not. That had nothing to do with it. Whether you love yourself, and they love themselves. They love themselves. And some of the rules, they would have to eat their meals with their hands. And, and soup. And you can't use your bowl as a utensil to pick it up to put soup in your mouth. You have to pick it up with your hand and eat. So after about a week or two of that, I said, okay, now we'll shift. And they didn't want to shift. They loved eating with their hands. And then another point of time, they had to go without toilet paper. No toilet paper. They had to wash their bottom somehow, and they had to use no toilet. Well, after 2 weeks of that, they didn't want to change. And they didn't have to, according to what they wanted to do. But because their bottoms were just as soft as gentle could be, and whatever rash that they'd ever had from using toilet paper improperly, they didn't have anymore. You see, they learned so many things during the School of the Master. They learned so many things about respecting themselves. But the biggest thing, and this is something that we could learn here, the biggest thing is that you are number one. You are number one. Nobody else has anything to do with your number one-ishness. You are number one. And you are the only person on the face of the earth. You create every other person or thing or situation around. It's your creation. So if I create him as a good person, super. If I create him as a bad person, that's my creation. And I have the right to create him any way I like. And why not create him good? Now, we talk about good and bad. Now, why don't I create him as a beneficial person? A person who likes himself. If I create him as a person who doesn't like himself, you might say that's bad. But it's not bad. It's just what he is. Now, is it beneficial to you to be a person who doesn't like yourself? Not very well. And what happens to you when you create yourself to be a person who doesn't like yourself? Then you don't like yourself. You don't even want to be in your own presence. Now, how do you create yourself to be a person who likes yourself? How do you create yourself to be a person who is number one in your world? Do you ever say that someone else did something to you that you didn't like? Do you ever say that? Did you ever say in your entire life that they did that to me? Or that there's problems in the world, there's wars going on? You created that war. Right here. You created that war. Yeah. And you can create that peace. I teach the song, the peace song, differently than what it was written. And I say, now, the only time there is now, there is peace on earth. And it began with my thinking. Now there is peace on earth, and it began with me. I don't say let there be peace. No, you do your part and we'll let there be peace now. Let there be peace now. Now you stop fighting. Stop putting up this thing. No, now there is peace on earth. Now, right inside of me, right inside of my heart, right inside of my life, right inside of my world. Now, only if you are number one can you say that. If you think that someone else is messing up your world, if you think somebody else is creating your world, then you can't say that. You see, you can't have your stem cell develop inside of you and completely exacerbate your entire body from its experience of imperfection to perfection unless you're number one. And when you're number one, what do? You take full responsibility for your world. Okay. Here you are walking a mountain path. And as you walk up this mountain path, it gets steeper and steeper and steeper. Now you're number one. Now why are you walking that mountain path? Because you want to walk the mountain path. It's no reason for it, no purpose, but you just want to walk it. But you do want to walk it, and you do want to get to the top because you'd like to take a look from the top and see what things look like up there. Just for the heck of it. And so, as you're walking up this path, you can go like this, straight up the path like this. Or you can walk like this, you know, and sort of serpentine your way up the mountain in a very peaceful, wonderful way. Now, I have a very good friend who is a mountain climber, and he likes to go straight up the mountain. He, right straight up, built like a little horse, you know, 6'9", and he just loves to walk straight up the mountain. Now, one day, his girlfriend wanted to go and see him in a cabin that he was staying in on top of the mountain. So, she mentally thought, where is he? And she was on the other side of the mountain, which is in New Zealand. And she wanted to go up and see John, and so to get up to see him, she had to go through this forest straight up to the top of the mountain. Now, she's a very normal lady, but a very gentle, tiny lady, much like you, a very tiny lady who is very, not fragile, but, you know, a tiny lady. And so she walked up this, she put her big cloud hoppers on and her short pants and so forth, and she walked straight up the mountain. Straight up the mountain, and to her, it was nothing. It was nothing to her. Why was it nothing to her?
She put no limitations on it.
Yeah, but why? Why was it nothing to her? Say it loud, please.
The belief.
Her belief, yeah, but why?
She was motivated to go see
She was motivated by what?
To go see him.
To see John. She walked up that mountain with John in her mind and her heart. And John walked up that mountain because he wanted to climb that mountain, and he's going to do it if he's going to kill himself. You know, she walked up that mountain because she had love in her heart. She had John in her heart, in her mind, and she just floated up the mountain just like a wonderful butterfly with no problem at all. Do you understand? Now, how can she float up the mountain? And she's a timid little thing, and he's a big rascal built for mountain climbing, and he puffed his way up. How? Now, if she had been up there and he went to see her, he might have had different motivation too. But his motivation was, I'm a tough old guy, and I'm going to push my way up this mountain, you know? Now, can you see? Who was number one? She was. She was number one because she put a motivation before her to see John. Now, was she successful? She sure was. Do you know, she went up that mountain, straight up like this here, and he was here. She didn't know his cottage was there. She didn't know that cabin on the top, she'd never been there in her life. But that was there. The helicopter took John up to the cabin, and he unloaded his stuff and put it in there. But then he walked up the mountain after the helicopter went down again. Because he's going to walk that mountain. And she came right up straight to it, you know, with her nose tuned in to John. Isn't that amazing? We say, not really. I mean, I can more or less see it. Well, can you see it in saying, I'm whole and perfect? Can you see it by saying to yourself, I now have those four chemicals, and I drink it, and every cell in my body turns into a stem cell. Wow. Every cell in my body returns to its original purity and integrity. I'm going to give you those four chemicals right now. Now drink them. Oh, he is ready. See, drink those four chemicals. Now, every cell of your body returns to your original purity and integrity. Do you believe that's possible? I do. Now, do we believe it's possible enough to do it? Can you say to yourself, as your one and only statement, I like me? Do you ever say about yourself you don't like yourself? You see, that messes it up. Every time you say, I don't like me, that takes you back to point one again, you know. Every time you say, I don't like me, that starts you at the very beginning. I have a special program that I give to people. You're looking at your watch? I have a special program. Nothing. No watch on. I have a special program that I give to people. It's called the 3-hour meditation. I say, if you can do the 3-hour meditation for a period of 6 months the way I tell you to do it, if you can do it, you will enjoy spiritual illumination instantly. If you do the 3-hour meditation like I tell you, you can enjoy the spiritual illumination instantly. Anytime along the way, too. You don't have to do it for the 6 months. But the first hour, you do nothing but say, I am God, God I am. I am God, God I am. I am God. Or say it, or sing it, or do whatever you want. And walk, or talk, but I am God, God I am. And just say it, say it, say it. And then the second hour, you say why you can say you're God. I am the creator of my world. I am the beautiful part of all that is. I am God. I am glorious. I'm spectacular. I mean, just look at my cells, how they operate, and just look at my body. The ability to see, only God can see like that, and hear and know things. And just and if you run out of things to say, then you repeat. And you keep saying this for the second hour, every day. And not the same thing, you can say the same thing if you want, but just new things will come to you. Because I would give seminars, and then during seminars I'd give the 3-hour meditation. And I would wax so poetic during these 3-hour meditations. On the second hour I'd be giving him why I can say I'm God. And it was just so glorious and so much fun. And then the third hour, this is the tough hour. This is the tough hour. This is the tough hour that separates the masters from the would-be masters. And that's the hour where you listen to the divine within, listen to God in you speaking, and don't fall asleep. That's the falling asleep part. That's the hardest thing. Because the moment you stop all your activity, I'm God, God I am, because I like me, and then you listen to the divine within, then you have a tendency to fall asleep. And the tendency is because you don't really think you're listening to God within, because it sounds just like you. And it is. It is. God in us is just like us. Now, I keep pointing to you, but you're watching television, and on television you're seeing the games, the sports games, you see the sports games, sports games, sports games, sports games, and then you go into your meditation, and you're listening to God speaking to you. And so God is talking to you about sports. God's talking to you about the sports game. God's talking to you about this team that won or that team that didn't win, and this team that had a good coach and that team that didn't have a good coach. And God's talking to you about that stuff. I mean, that's stupid, you know? No, it isn't. That's what God, you as God, are talking to yourself about. So you let that go. You let that flow. And you discard it. And you say, that's nice. That's nice, you know? God talks to me about sports. God talks to me about chasing women or chasing men or stuff like that. God talks to me about raising children. God talks to me about my workaday activities. That's true. God talks to you about everything because you're God and God is everything. Okay, now. So, but you want to get into the more delicious parts of it, you know. You want to get into the part where the divine is saying, you're wonderful, you're good, you're fantastic, you're glorious, you're beautiful, you're amazing, you know. And so, you just keep flowing with it. And you let this, okay, so the sports be, you let it be. So this is that, so you let it be. And so, pretty soon, those things no longer wake you up. Those things just drift by the wayside. And then, the divine inside of you starts speaking to you. From its higher level, if you will. From the level beyond the human. And the divine in you says, you're divinely made. Every organ, action, function of your body is your original purity and integrity. Every cell of your body is beautiful. Every cell of your body is divinely designed to be perfect right now. You are magnificent. You are magnificent. You are magnificent. You see, and pretty soon the divine impregnates your thinking, impregnates your thought, impregnates your mind with this idea that you are wonderful. And the other thought of the sports, the thought of any activities, disappear from your mind. And the only thought that comes in your mind is the beauty of you. Now, Randy was thinking about his new home. And so, as he thought about his new home, he dreamt about it, he ate it, he slept it, and pretty soon it became a reality. And then he said, well, now, this I want to change, and that I want to change. And then, pretty soon, that happened, and then it became a reality, and he no longer thought about that. Then, he went on to other things. Well, now, let's see, how do I do this and that? And then, his divine says, Randy, come on. Would you like to have the golden goose, or you want the golden eggs? Now, Randy, what do you want? And Randy says, well, hell, I want the golden eggs, and I want the golden goose. I want the both. And the divine says, well, that's just fine. But right now, you have to make a choice. Because if you're going to choose golden eggs, you'll have them one at a time. If you're going to choose the goose, you're going to be having them all the time. Every few minutes, you'll be having another beautiful golden egg, another beautiful fulfillment of who you are. Where do you want your consciousness to be? So Randy says, well, my goodness, what do you feed golden geese? And the inner self of him says, Randy, you're being too definite about that, too fundamental about this. Don't worry about feeding the golden geese. The golden geese that you're creating in your world, they're already fed eternally. They don't ever need to have anything to eat. Well, what about taking care of them and watering them? And what about having them outdoors and indoors and doing, and what about somebody comes along and steals the eggs? Oh, already you're worried about your eggs being stolen. My God, who's going to know you got a golden goose? Because if you tell people you got a golden goose, then you have to worry about it. So you don't tell people you got a golden goose. You only tell people, I listen to the divine within, that's your golden goose, and the divine within reveals all things to me. So now, when you do that, then the doors are always open for every single thing you could ever want or ever be interested in. Now, to say I'm number one means that you are number one. Now, I have found the keys to the kingdom. Do you think I'm going to give them to you? No.
But you can make copies.
Hmm?
You can make copies.
I can make copies, but yes, I found the keys to the, but this says no copies are allowed to be made, you know, apartment house type stuff. I found the keys to the kingdom. What am I going to do if I'm wise? Anybody? I'm going to use them. And Fox wrote the keys to the kingdom. How many people read his book? Out of everybody who saw the title of his book, Keys to the Kingdom, and realized that this man maybe knew something, I would say maybe only about 0.01% read the book. That doesn't sound like a lot. But you know, he's written up in many pamphlets and many things where you don't get the book, you just read that it's there. But how many people do it? Now, if I have the keys to the kingdom and you know it, you don't believe me. You don't believe me. Because if I had the keys to the kingdom, you know what you'd do? And you really believed? You would watch my every movement. You would watch everything I do. You would follow me, you know, very closely in everything I do because you'd want to copy me. You'd want to have me be your role model as the keys to the kingdom. You'd want me to be the guide for you into your spiritual life. And that's good. Now, then we run into another problem. We have what are called gurus, you know. And these are beautiful beings who are wise and fulfilled master types. And people go to India, wherever the gurus may be found, and they sit at their feet. And they say, oh, great guru, tell me what is going to happen. And the great guru says, this too shall pass, you know. and he gets sort of lackadaisical. The great guru does not have to teach you. The great guru is there for one reason. Anybody know the reason? To live it. To be himself. If any of you read Living with the Himalayan Masters by Swami Rama, a very fascinating book of him and his guru. And when Swami Rama would go with his guru on various sojourns, the guru would, it would be night and they'd lay down and go to sleep. And they'd have just their thin blanket over them. And the guru was virtually naked, and Swami Rama was probably too. And so they're lying there, and the next thing you know, Swami wakes up, and he finds he has two blankets on him. His guru had put his blanket on the Swami, because he knew the Swami needed a little more warmth. And the guru didn't. And so the Swami gets up and gives the guru back his blanket, and then lays down, goes to sleep, and the guru puts it back again. You know. But he didn't understand what the guru was. He didn't understand. He should have just said to the guru, Master, how is it you can sleep with one blanket and be comfortable? And the master would have said to him, I do not sleep with one blanket and I'm comfortable. I am comfortable. I am comfortable sans blanket. I am comfortable with blanket. I'm comfortable without. I'm comfortable because I'm comfortable. I am comfortable being me. I am comfortable being me, whether I walk through an ice-cold mountain stream, which is not ice-cold to me. I do not feel it. I am comfortable being me. And this is what the guru is teaching. He's teaching what he is. And the student doesn't learn and doesn't believe when the student gets too chummy with the guru. And he cuddles up to the guru and says, you know, we're buddies, we're pals, you know, I'm your special student, and I'm your... The guru has no special students. A master has no special students. A master only is himself. And a master looks at all the world and sees everybody having everything that they desire, seeing everybody fulfilled and beautiful, seeing everybody wonderful and joyful and whole and perfect. And so therefore, Jesus taught, we are not our brother's keeper. We do not go out and help our brother. We see our brother whole and perfect. We see him doing everything beautiful and good that we believe is right for us. Now, you can't do that because you're so emotional. You're looking, I feel so sorry for them. I feel so sorry for these little children who don't have this. I feel so sorry for this and that in the world. What a shame. I mean, it's your fault. And you associate with other humans who feel sorry. But you go out there and you see those kids and you say, hey kids, come here. And the kids come over to you. And you say, you know, I watched you. You all are absolutely brilliant. Oh, what? Oh, tell us more. You all are absolutely brilliant. All of you know that whatever thought you think, that's what you experience. Hey, what do you try and tell us? Well, your mind has the ability to accomplish what you want. Now, you tell yourself that you are comfortable. Just say, I'm comfortable. And then take off your shoes and walk in that stream and tell me whether you're comfortable or not. So, they say, you're right, I'm comfortable. And you know, with that, I know that God in me knows the answer. And they take off the shoes, and they go in the stream, and they're comfortable. And you say, aren't your feet cold? Why should they be? Why should they be? We had a little girl, she is 3 years old, and we were at a mountain stream in Switzerland, and it was ice cold, of course. And we were sitting at the edge of the stream, the bank was nice and warm, the sun was bright and nice, but the stream was coming down from the mountains. And this little girl went over to the stream, and it was not deep enough to cause a problem in any way. And she walked out into the stream, and she's puddling there, and she sat down in it, and she played in it, and she was doing all sorts of stuff. And her mother was watching, and I said, aren't you concerned about her walking in that stream? She said, no. I said, okay, good. And so after a while, maybe 20 minutes later, the kid came back, and she laid there on the grass with us, and she had her feet in the sun, and drying it, and I said, well, how was the water? Okay, why? You know, what is it supposed to be? I didn't feel any water except the water I felt for pleasure. I didn't feel water hot or cold. I only felt what was an enjoyment for me, tickling my feet, you see? Now, you say, Herb, that is almost unbelievable. And I say to you, don't kid yourself. You do this more often than you are aware of. And because you're not aware of it, when you do it, you don't realize you did it. Now, if you could have somebody be your little fly, and you'll be on top of your head, and go with you wherever you go, and keep a record of all the things you do, and all the things that you're not aware of, and all the things that are going on in your world, and you just do not realize they're going on, and you are untouched by them. And you say, my God, I couldn't imagine my being untouched by that experience. I couldn't imagine my being untouched by that, you know. But you were, because you were, on your consciousness, aware of something totally different, which kept you away from that which we were unaware of. Interesting, huh? Now, can we manage that sort of thing? Can we manage whatever it is we're unaware of? Can we manage going into a cold stream and not feeling it? How did Swami Rama learn from his master how to do it? He said what? I am comfortable. And what does comfortable mean? Comfortable means comfortable. Comfortable means not warm, not cold, just comfortable. You know? And you walk out into a rainstorm and it's just coming down, cats and dogs, and you say, I'm comfortable. It looks lovely around you. You're soaking wet. But I'm comfortable. And you don't put your head down like this, you don't pull your body in like this to make yourself uncomfortable. I'm comfortable. Oh, boy, it's so wonderful walking in the rain. You know, just Gene Kelly, remember him? Dancing in the rain, we're happy again. And this is what children do. And there's this little cartoon of Dennis the Menace. He's standing at the bus stop with his dad. And his dad's got the umbrella up there and he's got his raincoat on. And Dennis the Menace says, I don't know why you people are doing all this stuff. And he's naked as a jaybird. And the rain is fun. I'm having fun in the rain. And you guys are all bundled up against the rain, you know. And his father says, Dennis, you know. But you see, Dennis didn't know that he was supposed to be bundled up for the rain. He thought, rain, shower, time to get undressed, time to let the water fall down your body and enjoy it. And he did it. But you see, it takes a very creative cartoonist to come up with some of these thoughts that these guys come up with. And the cartoonists are really great psychologists, great minds. Now, what about you? Are you a great mind? Let's take a minute and look at that mechanism there. In 1901, divers recovered a shoebox-sized gearbox filled with gears from a 2,000-year-old shipwreck on the floor of the Mediterranean called the Antikytheria mechanism, or something like that. It is an all-in-one astronomical device in a single machine. The designer tried to put all of the knowledge he had about astronomical phenomena in it. The 30-odd bronze gears that it had and the 2,000 inscribed Greek characters in the device helped the ancient Greek scientists track the cycles of the solar system and calculate the motions of the sun, the moon, and the planets. The box technically qualified as a computer, and building one like that is not trivial. It shows how technically advanced that the Greeks were. And how technically advanced are you? How technically advanced are you? Let's take another point here of how we can straighten out our mind. This article is in the same Discovery magazine here, and it's not always a trove of all these delicious things, but mostly it is. And it says, why we sleep. And the article goes on to point out that during our sleep time, we have about 1,000 times a night billions of neurons which undergo a synchronous one second burst of non-REM electrical activity. 1,000 times a night this goes on, and what happens with each burst? It kills memories. It kills memories. During the day, he accidentally slipped and he caught himself. and he straightened up before he fell. Well, he remembers that. That's a memory. And then at another time, he picked up a cup of coffee that was just too hot, and he put it near his lips, and he said, oops, no way, not yet. And he didn't drink it. If he had drunk it, that would have been a memory too. You know, like, oh, that's so hot too. It burned my mouth. You see, we have billions, millions of memories in our minds that are trivial, that are totally unnecessary to our total existence. And the scientists are reporting this. And these memories block us from our growth. And so we have a built-in system, and they have this graphic display here of how these memories are killed off every night in our sleep, and how they're killed off purposely. Now, I have said to you, you are having millions of experiences every day that you're not even aware of. You're not even aware that you're not comfortable. You're just comfortable. You're untouched by a cold breeze or a warm breeze. You're untouched by the change in temperature. The temperature fluctuates around you an infinite number of times every day. You walk in the back room, it's one temperature. You walk up here, it's another temperature. You're standing here, and then I do this to you. And you're another temperature, a few degrees, you know, a few degrees of change. And most of the time, you don't even notice it. You don't even notice that. And those are the things that are part and parcel of the memory patterns that are thrown into your mind that take up the precious real estate of your mind. And taking up that precious real estate, it keeps you from having the thoughts that are true about you. The thought that you are number one, that you are the master, that you are the creator of your world, that you are the only one in charge of your life. Now, this is why they suggest having at least 8 hours of sleep a night. Now, the 8 hours of sleep a night are not times that you really are utilizing beneficially, because most of your sleep is done in dream things, and it's done in remembrances, and it's done in these bangs, these REM bangs that take place with this non-REM, where it busts them up and lets the memories go off into the nothingness. They no longer are held on. How many of you seen Bleep? You know, what the bleep do we care? Well, you saw those neurons and you saw the memory patterns as they were working in there, and they made it kind of humorous, but that's just how they work. That's just how they work. It bonds by saying, I like me, 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 until all of a sudden you have that bonding in your consciousness of I like me, and it belongs to you. But if you say, I like me, and then you hurt yourself and say, gosh, I don't like me, and then you hurt yourself and I don't like me. And you see, you're in and out and in and out, and you want to bond yourself like an animal might to a human or to another animal. You want to bond yourself with this movement of this, what's the term for that gadget? It's a nerve syntaxy or activity. And you want to bond yourself to your brain, to your neurons, and make yourself as a unified whole. Now, the way to do that is to do it with good affirmations. And these affirmations are very important to do. Now, I've had so many people come to campus for healing, and I don't do healing on campus or anywhere else, but I teach them how they do it for themselves. And I tell them, it's up to you now to put the cause in motion. You put the cause in motion by saying three affirmations most powerfully, and two others just for the fun of it. But you say these three affirmations most powerfully, and you say them again and again and again and again and again. Now, the first affirmation is, I like me. It seems like such a simple and impractical and not very powerful affirmation, but it is very powerful. Because you're going against everything the world tells you about you, everything you tell you about you. Now, I'm going to ask him a question, and he knows the answer already. But for whom do you dress?
Myself.
Now, in truth, For whom do people dress?
Others.
Others. You want to put on a show for others. Women dress so that others will notice them, you know. Women don't dress because they want to look good. I have a woman who has fairly large breasts and fairly heavy body, and she wears socks. Just a, you know, what do you call those moo-moo things, you know? And I say, what's wrong with you? Are you ashamed of your body? And get something that shows off your breasts and it shows off your beautiful figure. My beautiful figure, I'm fat. Well, so then show off your fat. And, yeah, you worked hard to get it, so to show it off, you know. And dress with things that complement the figure you got. And don't try to pretend you haven't got it because everybody sees what you haven't got and everybody knows what you haven't got and you're trying to say to the people you're not proud of yourself for what you haven't got, you see? So don't do that. Women who are heavy and they wear clothes that have lines that go horizontal, my goodness sakes, they really like to show off that they are, they should wear horizontals, you know, and then they should sort of swagger with the horizontal lines. But you see, this is the trouble. When we say I like me, we feel foolish, we feel facetious, we feel like we're lying to ourselves, and we shouldn't. If you don't like yourself, how can anyone else in the world like you? You know? Why should anybody else in the world like you if you don't like yourself? If I don't like myself, who's going to like me? And like Sue, my dear, beloved, wonderful, fantastic, happy friend who says to me, Herb, a lot of people don't understand you. And I say, Sue, I don't care. I am me, I like me, and I'm having fun, and I'm doing what I believe is right for me. She says, but they don't understand you. And I said, I'm not doing it for them. I'm doing it for me. I'm doing everything I do for me. And I said, you know, Lady Susan, you are exactly the same way, and that's why you see it about me. You see? She doesn't give one hoot and holler in hell whether you like her dresses or whether you like her hairdo or whether you like her earrings or whether you like the fact that she is a very definite person on nutrition and she's a very definite person about working with what do you call the work that she does here at the medicine wheel and massage and all that interesting stuff. And she's very definite. People come in there and she says, you've got to stop eating this and start eating this if you're going to have something happen for you, you know. And they say, hop, 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 hop. And she says, look, it's my business. That's what I'm here, and I'm a professional, and I know what I'm talking about, you know. And they say, okay, 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 you know. And they're intimidated, and they go out, and they do what she says because they're intimidated, and things happen to them. Miracles happen to their life. They say, my God, she's right, you know. But unless she scared the jabbers out of them, they wouldn't have done what she told them, you know. Because if she would have just gone in there and say, now, this is what you do. You just start eating good food like this and good food like that, and you start thinking good thoughts, and you go home the same jerk that you were when you came in. You know, untouched. Untouched. But once you give you a good swift kick, that's what Randy is there standing at the door for. You think Randy is giving you a blessing, but he's giving you that good swift kick. And he's making sure that you got your pills in your bottle there so that your alternative medicines are going to go home in a proper fashion. But I'm not kidding you. We must learn to like ourselves. And the only way to learn to like ourselves is to be ourselves. Be ourselves and have fun. And when you do whatever you do, do it because you're a happy person. I went to Nigeria and I taught the Nigerians to sing, I love Nigeria. I bless Nigeria, land that I love. They didn't. They liked their country, but they didn't know they liked it. And so I taught them this song. And so then what happens? We were teaching it at all the elementary schools. We had 12 elementary schools in 3 days that we went to. Oh boy, was that a busy schedule there. That was just Nigeria, not Ghana. And so we taught this, and the teachers wrote it down on the blackboard and everything, and the kids, hi, bless Nigeria, land that I love. I stand beside her and guide her through the night with the light from within. From the mountain to the valley, to the ocean white with foam, oh, bless Nigeria, my home, sweet home. They loved it when I did that. I bless Nigeria, my home, sweet home. Again and again and again. And then they went home, and their mothers and fathers were in the legislature because they had enough money to send the kids to school. You know, only the kids who had enough money to go to school could go to school. And so they were singing it to their mothers and fathers. Now, they couldn't take offense at it. The parents couldn't feel that that's wrong. And they just thought, hey, that's cool. So I went to the king, and I said to him, we have this lovely song that we're teaching to the Nigerians, and I sang it for him. And then my associate, Dr. Agabua, she got up, and she sang it in tribal dialect. And he says, my God, we've got to change this in the national legislature. This should be our national legislative song for Nigeria, you know. And of course, they don't know, but God Save the King is where that came from, you know, from England originally. And Americans changed it to God Bless America, and now it's I Bless Nigeria, and then I Bless Ghana, and I Bless every other place. But you see, teach people to like themselves. Teach people to believe that they can make a change in themselves first. And as they, I bless Nigeria, not God bless Nigeria, I bless Nigeria, land that I love. And they sang it, and they sang it, and they sang. We sang it on television, sang it on radio. We were singing it everywhere. As we would go around in the town, we would be hearing other people singing it that we didn't even know that heard the message of, but they heard it on television and stuff. And it gets through. But then, I like myself. I like myself. And then, first time I went down to Nigeria, I was wearing my normal clothes, you know. And so, hot, sticky, oh. And so they said, Herb, you got to wear one of our outfits. And I said, let's see what you got. And I knew what it was. It was a dress, you know. And so they brought out this dress. Oh, this filigree on it and all this pretty stuff on it. It was lovely. And I said, I have to wear that. I said, with nothing else underneath it, yeah, I have to wear that. And they said, yes, it looked good on you. I said, no, I don't think so. Thank you very much, but I got to be me. And so I wore my slacks and my t-shirt like this here, and I went all over Nigeria and did my thing. But I couldn't see myself pretending I'm something I'm not. I am not a dress wearer. I'm not one of these gowns. And the guys wore them, and the guys looked perfectly silly, you know. And you know, from American standards.
Oh, you don't know what you're missing, man.
Well, what am I missing?
By not wearing those, you don't know what you're missing.
Oh, you mean the experience?
Oh, they're great.
Oh, really? Well, next time I go down there, I must let them have a try one. Okay.
Don't limit yourself. Huh? Don't limit yourself.
Don't limit myself. Isn't she wonderful? Yeah, that's great. But no, you're probably right. You're probably right. But I just felt, hey, I don't feel right in doing it because everybody else is doing it. But if I do it because I don't want to miss a neat experience, okay, you give me a new motivation. And I like new motivations. I'm open to them, you know, because I like me. I like me. And I do all sorts of things. I went down to Guyana in South America, and many times we have many churches down there and many ministers that I've ordained down there and so forth, and 30-some. Well, they wanted to give me a special treat. So they took me out in the back country. They took me out into the jungles, into a special park that they had. It was a park for Nigerians. And it was right on the river, and you swam in the river, and they had all this stuff. And there were crocodiles in the river and stuff. And so I went swimming in the river with a couple others, and just floated around. And then I came out of there, and nothing to rinse off with, you know. It'd be just more river water. And so I dried off, and then we had a picnic, and then we went back, and everything was fine. And then when I got back in the United States, I mentioned to one of the medics that I had taken shots for going down to Nigeria, for Guyana, and he says, do you know that there is this, that, and the other thing? And I said, no. And he said, anyone who swims in those rivers is subject to that stuff if you haven't been given shots and what have you to protect you from it, you know. And I hadn't had to have them, so I didn't have them. And I was untouched. But my associate went down to Nigeria, and she and and my other associate went down there, and Ellen and Ingeborg. And Ingeborg has a cast iron stomach. And she was 79 at the time when she went down. And she has a cast iron stomach and eats anything and everything. We said, Ingeborg, do not drink the water. Do not drink any water, anything else comes in a bottle. Always drink the bottled water. So Ingeborg loved to eat everything they had, even stuff in uncooked water, you know. And so she left there and had the thought in her mind, body thought, and she went to visit her ex-husband in Trieste. And she was with her ex-husband in Trieste on the fifth floor of his apartment building. And she started to die. And Ellen called on the phone and said, let me talk to Ingeborg. She just felt. And Ingeborg, you should be in the hospital. And her husband just said, hey, yeah, she's just sick, you know. And so finally, the medics took her down, dropping her straight down, you know, from up straight down, and then took her to the hospital. And then Ellen got there and they said, she's going to die. And Ellen says, no, she's not. She's my soldier. She's not going to die. Now, Ingeborg, you're home first. And she said this to her perfectly. You're home first. You're home first. You're home first. And the doctor says, no, no. And we'll send the priest in, you know, and have him give the last rites. No, 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 priest. The priest would come in and pray with her, but no last rites. None of that stuff. And so she said, you're home first. So she said that for 2 days. And after 2 days, Ingeborg started changing slightly. Within a week of every day. And the doors were all open through the hospital in Trieste, and everybody could hear what Ellen said. You're home for it, Ingeborg. You're home for it. And Ellen has a very powerful, strident voice. And everybody heard it, and Ingeborg heard it. And Ingeborg, after it was about a week of Ellen doing this, rallied and came around and went home whole and perfect. But now, she could have died. She should have died. But Ellen went in there and changed her mind. Ellen went in there and said, Ingeborg, you're home first. Ingeborg, you're home first. Ingeborg, you're home first. Ingeborg, she would not let her fall into that trap. You know about traps, right? Yeah. Yeah. She would not let her fall into that trap. And she said, you're home first. I don't care what the illusions say. I don't care what the appearances say. You're home first. You're home first. You're home first. And she walked out of there whole and perfect. I mean, this is a fantastic woman. She's 80 years old. She's visiting again in Trieste. She was carrying her luggage, and she fell down and broke her arm. So she picks up her luggage and carries it to the train depot and gets on, and then she says, some arm hurts, you know. And so they got her to a doctor, and the doctor says, you're, you know, broken, two actual breaks. And she's carrying her luggage with her broken arm. Yeah. What a lady. So, she called Ellen. She's got a broken arm. Ellen says, you're home first. You're home first. You're home first. You're home first. And, puff. Puff right back in place. This is a principle. I'm not trying to be facetious with you. I'm telling you from actual experiences with it. I told you a story about my son, and if I didn't, I'll tell it again. If I did, I'll tell it again. He was about 18, 25. And we were taking our motorhome down into the city of San Diego to go out to dinner. And we were going to a vegetarian restaurant. And he said, Dad, I'll run around the block and make our appointment so that you can park and then come. And so I was driving the motorhome around the block looking for a place to park. Always crowded down there. And we didn't see him. And then we drove by the Shell station, and there was a lump of something in the driveway. And I just knew what that lump was. And I stopped and pulled up there, and there was my son. He had slid as he ran around and bang, his head on the concrete, you know. And so he was underneath these mats. I couldn't understand all this. But anyhow, my vision might have not been clear, too. And I just said, Mark, you're home first. Mark, you're home first. I kept saying it. Mark, you're home. He came to, I know, Dad, I know. And then he disappeared again, you know. And I said, Mark, you're home first. And he came back once or twice more. And the medics came. And then they picked him up. And the medics took him to the county hospital some blocks away. I got in a motorhome and beat the medics to the hospital. And got in the parking lot and got in there. And they brought him in. to the emergency area, you know, and there was nobody there to do to hold his head for the x-ray. And so they had taken him, instant x-ray of him, and they thought something was wrong. And I said, no, he's Hohenberg, he's Hohenberg. And so they, it was in the evening, and they didn't have any help, and they said, well, I need someone to hold his head still in the x-ray room while I take this x-ray. And I said, I'm here. And so I held it like a vice. He didn't move that head 1 inch, 1 millimeter. And I said, you're Hohenberg. He said, I know. And they took it, and there was nothing wrong. Nothing wrong before the evidence possibly. Now, just moments apart. You see, this is a principle. It's a principle that I want you to have and you to know and you to live and you to believe and you to enjoy. This is not something that is just a pat on the back and something to make you feel good. It's something that works. I don't ever wish you to have to use it. You follow me? I don't ever wish you to have a condition where you have to say, you're home perfect down there, person. You're home perfect. You're home perfect. You're home perfect. And then they stand up and say, thank you. You know? Oh, nothing was wrong? Leave it. You don't need the credit. You spoke your word and the principle worked. These are how people rise from the dead. These are how Jesus brought Lazarus back. What did he say about Lazarus? He only sleeps. That's the thought Jesus had in his mind about Lazarus and about the other ones that he worked with. They only sleep. And this is why medical doctors say, psychosomatic medicine, it only deals with the mind, it only deals... Hey, a body that was rotting in the tomb for a number of days, you know, not too much rot, but was pretty far gone, and then to click, be done. For people who have many problems, real problems, cancer, whatever you want, it works. It works. We have a principle here that knows only one thing but to do, to be, to fulfill whatever it is designed to fulfill. We have in our sleep time so much activity. In our non-REM time, there are, that they counted, 1,000 non-REM blasts that shot out, destroyed, disintegrated, dissolved dreams, memories that were no longer beneficial. Poof! Gone. And what happened to us because of it? If you didn't have that happen to you, you'd go crazy in no time.
You've been working overtime.
yeah. Your brain would be working overtime, and you wouldn't be able to sleep. You wouldn't be able to do anything, and you'd die. This is why people die. People die because their brain gets overloaded. It gets overloaded with stuff that is not beneficial to it. It's not that it's all bad stuff. It's just wasteful stuff. Whoops, I'm glad I didn't drink that hot cup of coffee. Oh, if I had drank that hot cup of coffee, would I have scalded the inside of my... And you visualize, you've got the whole thing going for yourself. But say to yourself, I'm comfortable. When you lie on your bed at night, say, I am comfortable. Here's a point. I didn't give you those points before either. But lie on your bed and say, I am comfortable. I am peace. I am comfortable. I am peace. And when you go to bed, when you fall asleep, you fall asleep with the words, I am comfortable and I am peace. Your body is like that. You don't know what you're lying on. You don't care what you're lying on. You could be lying on a ripple, you know. Dogs lay on all sorts of things because they don't think about that. When we were in the Navy, whenever we had a chance to take a nap, we'd lay down. And we'd lay down on whatever was there. It doesn't matter. We didn't have time to clean things apart. We just lay down. Boom, we wake up, rested. No lumps in our body. Okay. I'm comfortable. I'm relaxed. I'm in peace. I'm comfortable. And you wake up, relaxed. And now, when you go to bed, say, I am comfortable, I am peace, and don't think I have to get up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom. Don't think that, because if you think that, you put that cause in motion. Now, you think, I sleep straight through the night, and I wake up at exactly, it's 9 o'clock, I go to bed, I wake up exactly at 5, okay? If I do whatever, I wake up exactly, and you do. You don't need an alarm clock, you don't need anything else, you wake up exactly, and you say, I sleep straight through. And you don't have to get up and go to the bathroom, you don't have to get up and feel unsure about something. You just sleep straight through because you are comfortable and you are at peace. Okay, now, here are the healing points that I was making before. I'll give them to you quickly so if I get diverted, I won't let you be without them. I like me is the first one. I am divine order is the second one. All, you don't say all is in divine order because you don't give a damn about the rest of the world. You just care that you're in divine order. And if you're in divine order, the rest of the world's in divine order, you can be sure. But I am divine order. Not in, but I am divine order. And then, I am peace. See, now those three, with whatever healing, mental, spiritual, physical need that you have, you say, I am divine order, I am peace, I like me. Preferably, I like me, I'm divine order, I'm peace. You will find that all of those things will fall right into place and you will be the master and your body will be in perfect divine order. Boom! Then I like to throw in these extra two just for the fun of it because I think they're kind of fun. I'm independently wealthy. How about that? Is that acceptable? And this one. This is a terrible one. This is one that can get you into a lot of trouble. I am spiritually healed. And when you have spiritual healing, you have no memory of a past. You live only in the now, here and now. There is no yesterday. Your body is in yesterday. This is a new you. This is a new I am what?
Spiritually healed?
That's right. I just wanted. I am spiritually healed. To be spiritually healed means that there is no past. If they were to look in the hospital and find the records about you, there'd be no record that you had XYZ problem, you know? There'd be no record that you ever were in the hospital. Your mother wouldn't remember anything about you. Your family wouldn't remember anything about you of what that XYZ. It didn't exist. Spiritually healed means a spiritual wholeness that has no recollection of whatever was healed. You follow me? It's a very difficult concept, but it's a very real concept. If you are spiritually healed, you have no recollection of the past. You have no recollection of anything other than what you are now. Now you, if you would like to say, I live in my ideal spirit, mind, and body, and I am spiritually healed now, then whatever you conceive in your mind of your spiritually ideal body, you would have it that way. Now your clothes wouldn't fall off of you, and things like that wouldn't happen, but everything would be in divine order. You would be wearing the ideal set of clothing that you like, size 36 waist or 32, whatever you like, and you know, whatever form that is pleasing to you. But you would be whatever you choose. When you choose that for yourself, then that is who you are. Now, you say, well, why don't you do this, Mother? And others do. Hey, don't worry about why don't others do it. You do whatever it is that's good for you. Her need is totally different than your need. And his interest is totally different than your interest and your interest. I mean, you two are married, right? You two are married, aren't you? Yeah, I mean, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That's none of my business. But, I mean, you two are married. And so, but you are two different people. And your interests and many of your desires are so divergent to his, and many of his are the same to yours. But the thing is, you harmoniously work together because each of you allows for each other to be yourself and have fun. And it makes it nice. But because you believe in yourself. Because you are working on your spiritual healing. Now, say for instance you had bad teeth. And you say to yourself, I am spiritually healed. And bad teeth were your hang up. And now you're spiritually healed. He would never remember that you ever had bad teeth. He would never know that. You see what I mean? So when you're spiritually healed of anything, whatever that was, nobody would ever remember it. Nobody would, not even you. You wouldn't remember it. And that's the tough part of spiritual healing. Because there's no scar to show. There's no proudness for being healed of something. You know, hey, Mom and Dad, I haven't got it anymore. They say, you haven't got what? I haven't got what I used to have. Well, what did you used to have? I don't know. I thought maybe you could tell me, but I don't have it anymore. But, you know, this is a silly thing. This is a silly thing. But that's what the game is all about. And that's what you're all about. Okay, now. That is what I teach people to do for spiritual healing when they're on campus. And they walk around the campus grounds and they say this again and again and again. The three basic statements. And when they leave campus, they leave as unique, evolved people with the healing is theirs if they are willing to let it go. If they're going to say, but, then they still got it. If they say, I like me, I like the new me, I like the new me, I like the special me, I like the comfortable me, you know, I like the comfortable me, isn't that nice? And then, in the 3-hour meditation, when you do the 3-hour meditation, you first say, I'm God, then you say why you can say it, and then you listen. And if you can do that for 6 months, for every day for 6 months, without falling asleep, because if you fall asleep, it's okay, but you got to start over. You got to start the 6 months over. You might be at 5 months and you're 11th hour, but you got to start over. Not because there's any magic in that, but there's magic in you being the master of yourself. There's magic of you being, I didn't say anything about I'm God or why I say I'm God, but the magic of staying awake to listen to the divine in you for that 6 month period without falling asleep for 1 hour. And I have it from 6 a.m. in the morning, three to six in the morning. From 3 to 6 every morning, because that way it's the only time you can find when there's nobody else around to bother you, you know, usually. And so, that's the basic reason you choose the time, so there's nobody to bother you. And then you do that for 3 hours every morning for 6 months, and now, I guarantee you, at the end of that 6 months, if you've done it without falling asleep, if you fall asleep, it's no big deal. This is for you. This is for you, it's not for somebody else. If you can keep yourself from falling asleep by getting excited about what you're doing. When I give these seminars, in Nigeria especially, they're sitting on these concrete floors, no pillows. And the people come in from the outlying tribes, and they're coming into this house. And this house is cold, damp, wet. It's 84 degrees, but it's cold. There's a very damp wetness in the air. And there's no lights, no electricity, a few candles maybe. And they're sitting on the floor, and you know, there's nothing to lean back on, and some of them want to lean back, and some of them want to fall asleep, and some want, okay, that's great. Well, I've done it a number of times down there, and they are magic people. But the real magic people were the ones in Guyana, in South America, in Guyana. Those people, we met for a series of evenings at this one church. And this church was, again, a concrete floor. And the rule was the people had to be there by 2:30 in the morning from wherever they came. And what public transportation is running in the middle of the night, you know? And so they had to ride their bikes, and they had to walk, and they had to get help from somebody. And they had to start out maybe at 10 o'clock at night to arrive there at 2:30 in the morning. I mean, these people were diligent. And we had almost 100, not quite 100 people in that room. And that was stuffed. That was stuffed. And they came in, and they got there some early, you know, to make sure they got there. And they filled it. And they were just packed like sardines. And you had to sit there, and I sat cross-legged, and I sat like this, you know. And then, you don't have to, but I did that because I'm comfortable. I'm comfortable, you know. How can you do that for 3 hours, you know? I'm comfortable, you know. Okay, so then I did the three-hour meditation with them. And it was so exciting. I mean, I could just feel the excitement in the group. It was so exciting doing this for this group that when we came to the third hour, everybody's like this, like eyes open because forced, but it was just because of their great interest. Then at six, I got up to go. I wanted to go to the bathroom, and other things. And nobody else wanted to leave. They sat there and continued in meditation. I don't know how long, because I went upstairs and had breakfast in the house and things like that. But I know when I came down a couple hours later, there were still people milling around. But they loved it every single day we did it there. And miracles happened. And when I did it in a large monastery in Switzerland. This is a beautiful monastery, a beautiful monastery in Switzerland in Lugano. And we had this whole monastery to ourselves because it wasn't being used as a monastery anymore. They used it just for retreats and stuff like that. So we could choose pretty much the cell we wanted and so forth. And so they had this gigantic a Catholic sanctuary, and we said we'd like to use it. They said certainly, and we said, well, now can we push the altar and so forth out of the way so we can do our own in the middle? And they said, oh yes, sure. And so the brothers all stood around hiding, listening and watching what we were doing, and we did our own and we did our thing in there, and it was so spectacular because the acoustics were resonating around. When we did it at the Menninger Foundation, the OM period that we first were learning there, it was so resonant and so round, and just wonderful things happened to people. People just felt their very being uplifted and dimensionally fantastically glorified, you might say. But it was just great. And we did it in many other monasteries, and in a convent we did it in France. And as we did it in this convent, the nuns were looking in. And then afterwards, we did our own, and then we'd hug each other, and then we'd kiss each other on the mouth. And so the Mother Superior came to us and said, would you mind doing it in a different room? My nuns are all shook up. And, I mean, the nuns are supposed to be unworldly and untouched by those things, but they were touched by it. But it was a wonderful thing. I like me, I'm divine order, I'm peace, and say these things. And when you say, I am spiritually healed, what wonderful things happen. You know, you all are fantastic. And if circumstances would allow, we could go on for a long time too, or take a break or whatever. But we've come to the end of our program today, right, Randy? Mm-hmm. I think this is the way you scheduled it. And we've got a lot more of this. We have a lot more beautiful illustrations that we can give of things that have happened and experiences that I have regularly as I go on seminars, even as I am here. And tell you about them another time. But thank you for having me as your speaker and your guest. It's been an honor to be here. And I think you have two magnificent people, Randy and Susan, to guide you along your spiritual path and along your physical path. And the more advice and attention you give to them to follow what they say without arguing and without feeling that you know better because you've been there and done that, the quicker you'll have the results that you want. So again, thank you very much, and I love you, I love you, I love you.